Well, good morning. This is Per Fagerang, and our program is Fight the Empire, and our guest today is Tom Engelhart, who is the co-founder of the American Empire Project, and he runs the Nation Institute's Tom Dispatch, a real good website. And he's got his latest book just published is The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. So, Tom Engelhart, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks a lot.
Why don't we start out? Tell us a little bit about the book, and then we'll get on to our topic.
Well, you know, the book is really an attempt to look at what's become an American way of life, which is the American way of war. And the American way of war is we're garrisoning the world, we're fighting very distant wars, but the American public itself is extraordinarily detached from this. And I discuss both the, you know, what's happening and what's come to be called the homeland, a very strange Bush word. And in the book, I spend a lot of time on what the American way of war is, which is the creation of military bases around the world in a way that's historically unprecedented, instead of colonies, the use of air war in various ways, and what war itself has become, which is increasingly what we in this country at a distance like to call collateral damage, that is, the death of civilians. Increasingly, if you think about it, war, the death of soldiers is the collateral damage, and the death of civilians is the central aspect of modern war, not just American war, but it's distinctly so with American war, too. And we just don't think of it that way.
Boy, speaking of bases, how many bases do we? I've heard all sorts of numbers from 700 all the way up to 900 and something.
Oh, or more. I mean, the problem is it depends on what you're counting.
Right.
The military, the Pentagon kind of fesses up to about somewhere in the 700s, depending on what year you're looking at. They call them sites. But they, first of all, they don't include bases in war zones, and they don't include bases that are uncomfortable. We have a base in Jordan of sorts. We share bases in Pakistan. These are both kind of uncomfortable. They're not counted in the official Pentagon count. Then, if you look just at a place like Afghanistan, where we've gone on a kind of a base building frenzy, from small outposts to massive bases, we have about 400 in Afghanistan alone. At its height, we had about 300 in Iraq. These go from minor outposts to things that are, you know, 20-mile perimeter, you know, double PXs, many bus routes, you know, basically American small, fortified small towns. So I would say, depending on what you're counting, somewhere between 750 and, I don't know, 1,100, 1,200, something
like
that. Oh,
my. Well,
I mean, when you think that supposedly the Brits, at the height of their empire, had maybe 40 bases worldwide, the Romans, 37 in major bases. You're talking about something that's just never happened before on the face of the earth, and yet in this country, unless a local base closes, you know, if you're the base in your town in the United States, because most of our bases are here, of course, if it closes, there's an uproar. It becomes headlines in the papers. Otherwise, basing stuff is for policy wonks and people in Washington. It's not news. Millions of Americans know about it because they've been on the bases. They've been soldiers, they've been civilian contractors, whatever. But otherwise, you know, it's not dealt with as significant news here. And so we rarely think about the way in which we garrison the world. Mm.
Well, let's get on to this article you wrote on the drone wars. Why don't you sort of briefly describe what the drone is so they know what we're talking about?
Well, the drone is a robot. Basically a robot airplane. It can be flown. Once it's in the air, there has to be somebody at an airbase to help take it off. I mean, not in the plane, but at the base. So there has to be a local person taking it off and landing it. But once it's in the air, the actual plane, which has no pilot, is flown by a, quote, pilot who might be up to 7,000 or 8,000 miles away. In other words, the drones, which were initially in the 1990s surveillance planes, just after after 9/11, they were armed with missiles for the first time, and then they became initially kind of assassination planes. They could sit up there over some country 24/7. I think the first assassination was probably in Yemen. A missile from one of these drones blew up a car with supposedly six Al-Qaeda guys inside of it, but of course they were turned into ashes, who knows. And now they've become a kind of a way of war over the Pakistani borderlands, a country we're not at war with, but where our drones in large numbers are flying every day and in multiple times a week, simply loosing missiles or bombs on people who might or might not be bad guys, so to speak. And those are being flown. Those are CIA planes. They're probably being flown from Langley, Virginia. The Air Force ones in Afghanistan are being flown by teams of three, a pilot, a cameraman, and some kind of intelligence analyst from, usually it's like Creech Air Force Base outside Las Vegas, say, or other places in the American West. It's a rather extraordinary development of modern warfare, as a start.
How high do they fly?
I without having my papers here, I couldn't tell you, but they fly high enough. I mean, they can fly quite high, and they can stay in the air for many, many hours, more than a human pilot could stay in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And they pack wallop. I mean, the most advanced that are regularly up there, the Reapers, as in Grim Reaper. The names of the things are kind of classic in themselves. They can pack about four missiles or a bunch of bombs. I mean, they have real power. You know, they're significant instruments of war. And these are just, these are really, if you think of them historically, these are still as powerful as they are. They're the Model Ts, if you think of them in car terms, of the Model T Fords of drones, because the Air Force is already planning drones through about 2047. And imagining them someday as planes that will fly without the intercession of human beings at all. That is not just fly, but make decisions about who to kill and so on and so forth.
My.
So
mm-hmm.
We're heading into what might be considered Terminator country. That's the drone. And right now, I mean, they're being used regularly. They were used in Iraq, and they're still over Iraq. They're being used regularly in Afghanistan, and the CIA is conducting what's really the first civilian air war, certainly the first civilian drone war over Pakistan, and it's escalating.
So, and you say that there are about 7,000 of them in operation right now?
Well, the figure I got, that's a figure that I, again, it's so hard to tell the counts on these things. There aren't 7,000 armed ones. The armed ones are in the hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers in the thousands that are in operation are surveillance ones of various sorts, some very small.
Yeah, I guess the armed ones would have to be a certain size just to carry more than a missile or more.
Yeah, and they take more time to produce and so on and so forth. But they're a lot cheaper than planes,
mm-hmm.
And they are being hailed as our new wonder weapons. I mean, Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, at one point in the last months said, talking about disrupting Al-Qaeda, that he called them, quote, the only game in town. The problem is that, like all wonder weapons, I mean, we've lived in modern times and industrial times, we've lived through a succession of wonder weapons. You know, there was the tank in World War I. There was the airplane itself, hailed as a wonder weapon. The airplane was going to end war. It was so devastating, it would end war. There was the atomic bomb, which after being used twice, nobody's ever been able to use it again. The thing about wonder weapons is they seldom meet, I could almost say, never meet their promise. That is, they don't end wars. They don't decisively end warfare. They usually don't do what the publicity says they're going to do. But by the time they become less wondrous, they've lodged in our world and they don't go away. They get the money around them. They get lobbying around them. This is already happening around the drone. The drone will not solve our Afghan and Pakistan wars. It won't turn out to be a wonder weapon, whatever it can do. It's reasonably precise. It can hit certain targets. But there are a lot of problems with drones, but they're not going to solve the problem. But by the time they don't solve the problem, we will have a drone race in the world. There are already 30 or 40 other countries starting to develop them, including, say, Iran. And they are conceptually very dangerous weapons because along with them goes the idea that these things, which are basically assassins, can be flown over any place you don't like, and you can choose who the bad guys are. You can execute them, and that's that. Now, that feels okay to us as long as we're doing it. But wait till the Iranians do it for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Well,
this is a very dangerous road that we're going down without without much thought. The development of the weapons, as often happens with science, has so outpaced, you know, the so-called laws of war, anything else. It's just outpaced everything. So this is it's just a dangerous development, and I think what makes it more dangerous is that it's the first kind of warfare that's really pulled human beings, at least on one side, off the battlefield, which is rather extraordinary. I mean, there's only one human side to this battlefield when you have drones, and it's detached us. It's really turned war into a kind of video war, you know, and it literally in this case. But it is a weapon, and this is something that I wrote about at TomDispatch.com, and I've also written about it in my book, The American Way of War. It is a weapon it's almost the perfect weapon for our moment, for our American moment, because the detachment of those pilots 7,000 miles away from the world where they're dropping bombs, rather is very similar to the detachment of American society from the wars it's fighting. I think there's a strange, we have, in a funny sense, pilotless wars.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of, in a way, it's like the U.S. is playing God, you know?
Yes.
And the thing that strikes me is that, well, a lot of things strike me about this, is it can inflict a lot of violence, but as far as strategy goes, it doesn't hold any territory. It just kind of flies over the territory, dropping these thunderbolts, but somebody's still got to go. If you want to fight a war, you still have to have soldiers going in there to, hold the ground. And, of course, then they are targets themselves.
And largely, there's no ground to be held because the people in the Pakistani borderlands, the people who are being attacked, are largely what we call terrorists, and they're not really attached to. It's not like taking Berlin or something. I mean, the truth is, this is one of these questions I ask about Afghanistan. Everybody says, and I just put up a piece at Tom Dispatch about this, because it's true that the Afghan war is going terribly. But of course, the question that people don't ask is, what if it were going well? I mean, what if it all happened? We more or less won a la Iraq. So what? We would then be in bare possession of the world's number one narco state, the world's fifth poorest country, the world's considered to be the world's second most corrupt country. I mean, and we would have one country, theoretically, but probably not practically, safe from, quote, terrorists, but that wouldn't solve the problem of the rest of the globe, because that's not the way terrorism works. I mean, it's a very strange thing, this war that we're fighting in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan. It's as you say, very destructive, and quite destructive of civilians, as we know. Partially because, if you have pilots 7,000 miles away and planes robot planes up in the sky, you have to have very good, even if they're precise, you have to have very good intelligence. And as is always the case in situations like this, it all depends on the people who are feeding you intelligence, who may be killing people they simply don't like or feeding you misintelligence. It can be anything. This happens in Afghanistan all the time. We know less about what's happening on the Pakistani border, except that civilians are dying.
Well, I think the reason for war in Afghanistan is it's sort of a stepping stone to control of Central Asia, but that's sort of another topic. But
I think the thing is that was true. That is, if you're talking about the Bush administration, the one thing you can say about the Bush administration is that they were visionaries. They were kind of mad visionaries, and they were quite wrong in their vision. But they were looking at a globe. They had a very global vision. They were very geostrategic. And you're right. They were imagining energy flows around the planet. They were imagining how you would roll Russia back. They were imagining the importance of Central Asia, both in terms of Russia and in terms of oil supply, energy supplies, and so on and so forth. I think the Obama administration, they're like managers of war momentum. I don't think they're thinking this way anymore. But, wasn't it Emerson who said, had that famous quote about, man in the saddle, things in the saddle, not man.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the war, at this point, war is in the saddle, and they're barely managing it.
Well, the thing that strikes me about this kind of warfare is that, here's some guy sitting in a cubicle, say, in Nevada, you know, and he kills, you know, people 7,000 miles away. Then his shift is up. He goes home to his wife and kids, you know, and maybe they go to Disneyland or, you know, Little League or something like that. It just kind of it sanitizes war in a way. It just
there at least was a sign as the pilots left. The pilots, I put that in quote, left Creech Air Force Base. You know, this is I think it's north of Las Vegas. There was a sign at the base as you drove out saying something like, "Be careful. This is the most dangerous part of your day." And of course, they were right because you were going on an American highway, and you were in danger. But of course, you know, these pilots who they dress in uniforms, they feel to some extent as if they're at war, but their commanders are trying to figure out how to redefine valor so that it applies to people who are 7,000 miles away, because you need that for the various Air Force combat citations. But you're right, they're living in a you are literally living in a detached world from war in a way that wouldn't be true if you were, say, an artilleryman, even significantly back from the battlefield, or even if you were in an F-16 over Afghanistan right now, where you couldn't be touched. I mean, we forget that what we call air war, even forgetting the robots, is now American air war is basically a one-way process of slaughter, because our enemies can't touch us. So, but at least that guy in an F-16 over Afghanistan, the motor could fail. You know, the engine could fail. You know, something could happen. There could be a problem in the plane. There is some element of danger left. But there's none here except getting on an American highway. It's a very strange form of war, and it's going to become a more common form of war. And when it happens to us, or the equivalent happens, you know, the Cubans find some guy in Miami, like that guy who blew up the Venezuelan plane, I think
Orlando Bosch, I think his name is, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've forgotten his name.
Posada Carillas.
Yeah, and they decide to target him. They don't have a drone, but they just send some guy over, plants a bomb next to his apartment. The apartment blows up, they get him. But, you know, a bunch of people in the apartment house die. You know, we would declare war. And that's functionally what we're doing. You know, in a land... In more than one land, but particularly in Pakistan and the Pakistani tribal border areas, that we're not at war with.
Well, this is Fight the Empire, and our guest is Tom Engelhardt, who's wrote a really interesting article on drone warfare. It's in tomdispatch.com. It's interesting. You talk about valor. That was a great quote that you had in your article about from this Colonel Mathewson. Valor to me is not risking your life. that kind of really stopped me, you know.
I know, but you know, we tend to remake language to suit our needs regularly. It's not surprising. I mean, we lived through an endless version of this in the Bush administration. You know, I mentioned the word homeland before. You know, which was one word that really totally shocked me, because I considered it before then, I would have considered it an un-American word. It was something that went with the Germans or the Russians, fatherland or something. But
it was and motherland. I wonder what's the difference.
Yeah. I mean, homeland, it was a strange... It was lurking before 2001, but, you know, 2001 loosed all sorts of things in our world. Same thing with the global war on terror. I mean, you know, which goes right on today. I mean, one of the strange things about the Obama administration is how much, in foreign policy terms, it's really an extension of the last couple of years of the Bush administration. You can't find an inch of difference on most matters. I mean, for instance, you know, the Washington Post reported the other day that that in the Bush period, the Pentagon had gotten special operations forces into 60 countries. This is global war on terror. They were either training, fighting, preparing. The Obama people have actually upped that, 75 countries. You know, same global war. I mean, they've dropped the name. You see, they've done something else with names. In the case of the Obama people, they've dropped some of the Bush stuff, the naming stuff, but they've kept the thing underneath it.
Well, the U.S. still gets to define who is a terrorist and who isn't, you know, another aspect of playing God.
Yes.
You know, the U.S. is the judge and the executioner all at once.
And that's what the drones particularly do. Of course, they particularly emphasize. I mean, air power does that anyway. You're overhead. Your view is a God's view, of mm-hmm. course, because you're overhead. Down below are teeny little beings. They might look like ants. They might be a little bigger. You know, if you've seen that WikiLeaks thing, you can kind of see they're people, but they're just, you know, barely people down there. So it's a godlike view, and mm-hmm. that increases the idea that you can, you know, pass judgment from on high and so on and so forth. I mean, I don't think the degree to which that plays a role in all this is worth thinking about. I mean, the actual view from above can be a very dangerous and deceptive view, and it tells you nothing about what's really going down on the ground, mm-hmm. what's going on down on the ground most of the time.
Well, you know, there was a famous quote from when Italy invaded Ethiopia back in the 30s, and there was a Italian pilot, I think it was actually Mussolini's son-in-law, and he talked about how you drop a bomb into a crowd of people, and they kind of, from above, it looks like this, like a flower unfolding or something.
Yeah, he compared it to flowers. That was Count mm-hmm. Ciano, I remember, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember, I, of course, I'm not quite, I'm pretty old, but not quite that old, but I remember the quote, yes.
Mm-hmm.
He admired the look of it. It was kind of beautiful. Yeah.
Sort of artistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do the victims fight back? It seems to me the only response, if you're a victim of a drone, you can't, you can't send somebody to Nevada. You can go after whatever troops are on the ground, or, you know, you can use some form of terrorism.
For those particular, the peasants who are just under the missiles, there's probably no way to fight back whatsoever. I mean, it's just, on the other hand, you know, what it doesn't do is to make you friends. I mean, my own guess is that to some extent, I mean, listen, there's no question. The drones aren't just fantasies. They really knock off. They've knocked off a certain number of Al-Qaeda figures. They've knocked off Taliban figures. They really do this. They are accurate. In certain ways, but when the information is correct, but my guess is that overall they actually are terror creators. That is, they're killing people who we think should be killed, but they're just killing other people as well, and
mm-hmm.
and that creates an atmosphere which may be an atmosphere of fear, but also an atmosphere of desire for revenge, and not only, you know, one person's killed, but particularly in societies where there are all sorts of familial or tribal linkages, and where that's important, you end up with a lot of enemies. In the long term, it's how things blow back to us is unknown, and I'm hesitant to predict. But I think it's like the drone in the long run, and our wars more generally, are kind of blowback producers.
Well, you know, technology has a way of spreading, and you mentioned in your article, I think 40 other countries are working on drones, and you mentioned, like, Hezbollah used them, I don't recall, can you tell us a little bit about that? Hezbollah used them against Israel in 2006?
They flew drones in the 2006 summer war. I mean, Israel was a pioneer in drone warfare, you know, mm-hmm. for obvious reasons, and they were probably the first country to use them as assassins. Targeted killings, as they're called now. We don't call them assassinations.
Mm-hmm.
And they've used drones to go after Palestinians they didn't care for, and others who just happened to be around. But Hezbollah also had, I assume, a small number of drones, and they did at least in one or two cases fly them over Israel. These were not armed drones, as far as I know. They were surveillance drones. I don't even know what they were doing. All I know is it happened. One of them was shot down. Iran has them because the United States shot an Iranian drone down over Iraq, some months back. I'd have to look. It was, because oddly enough, I mean, we don't think much about Iraq anymore, but the U.S. controls, because Iraq doesn't have an air force, the U.S. controls Iraqi skies. And in that case, we shot down an Iranian surveillance drone, went over Iraqi territory, and the U.S. Air Force shot it down. The Iranians are now supposed to be producing, they claim they've started production lines for both surveillance drones and armed drones. Other countries are obviously following. The thing is, there's no longer what we would traditionally call an arms race, as in the great power arms races that started in the late 19th century with dreadnoughts and went on until the Soviet Union collapsed. But what we have now is a kind of an arms race of one. The United States develops these things, they're out ahead, and then they break a path, and other countries simply follow.
Well, eventually, it seems inevitable that at some point, some hostile nation or entity, you know, we would call them terrorists, will use a drone against us.
Absolutely. I think we can already imagine the first suicide drone.
How would that work now? That was
since drones don't have pilots to begin with, you know, mm-hmm. assumedly you could create a drone with you know, some kind of bomb or bomb material in its nose cone or wherever and just run it into something. I mean, it seems drones aren't hard. You can go online. There are do-it-yourself sites for building modest drones of one sort or another. You can go find this stuff. It's just online. I mean, this is not the most complicated. I mean, the stuff that we're using is more complicated, but this isn't the most complicated thing in human history. And and I think you just have to assume that sooner or later, you know, non-state groups are going to be able to create their own drones and use them as they wish.
So basically, suicide drone is just one that doesn't come back.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In other words, the drones we have now, they keep flying one mission after another, but the
That's
suicide
right.
drone
come back.
Would
they're,
just...
They're very, they mm-hmm. are very prone to error. A significant number of them do crash. I mean, not, but a modest number of them at least crash and don't come back. But yes, basically they come back, we take them off, we land them, they're used over and over and over again. And, you know, they cost, you know, $4 or $5 million a pop. I mean, they're not inexpensive, mm-hmm. but they're not a $350 million advanced jet either. I mean, they're relatively cheap to produce.
Well, I think we're getting near the end of our time, and I just read recently that the U.S. is using drones along the Mexican border now. They're just spy drones so far.
Yes, and they're talking about what? The Canadian border and police department. I mean, the thing is, like all inventions, you know, drones will come home too. You know, police departments are talking about wanting to use them now. And I mean, the weapons like this spread. Once they start, they spread in all sorts of odd ways. I mean, we've seen this at the worst level with nuclear power, where we've been in a snit over the possibility that Iran might produce nuclear weapons for how long now? You know, years and years and years. But the proliferation of nuclear power, of nuclear weapons, I mean, it's just an obvious thing. We worry now that non-state groups will get them sooner or later, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, once you get a new weapon like this in the world, without thinking about it and declaring that it's a wondrous thing that's going to win you your wars or it's the only game in town or whatever it is, the thing itself gains a kind of momentum. It starts to spread. It moves into other areas, other niches. Other people get it. And, all, you know, I think that's just it happens over and over again.
Oh, boy. Welcome to the future. Well, I think our time is up. This program's time is up. I hope our time is not up.
No.
We've been talking with Tom Engelhardt, who runs the TomDispatch.com. It's a good website to be on their list. And thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Hope we talk again sometime.
Any old time.
And this is Per Fagrang, Fight the Empire. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.